Hello, Screeters. What is happening, my friends? I haven't been running any games. I haven't been playing any games. I can't say that work has got me down, but it's got me busy. But it is a little slower this week. So it's kind of picking exactly the wrong days to be busy, but we're going to do what we do when we do what we do, like we did when we did what we did. Oh my God. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. But I have quite a few call-ins again, which I'm really excited about. I'm not saying they're earth-shattering or record-breaking. In fact, like the economy, I feel like call-ins are down. But I don't really listen to anybody's show. I always used to say, hey, if you don't have enough call-ins, it's because you're not calling into enough shows. So if one of those things is truly my objective, then I think be the change that you want, right? Enact. Other people aren't going to change for you. You need to change and do what you need to do in order to make that situation become what you want it to. But what the hell do I know? Well, I know that today is Thursday, April 7th, 2022. I am Jason Hobbs, and this is Random Screed.
Hey Hobbs, it's Arlen. I thought I would call in a little bit about character death in games, and especially characters coming back from death in games. But first I'm going to comment on the kind of goblin intimidation thing, which is to say, I really like that. I think it's something that you kind of have to like establish a setting that works that way, because not every setting does. But I really like the idea of like hostiles are not really interested in like killing you or fighting to the death or anything. They really just, you know, want your cash. And so if you like the way that, for instance, in Mountain Blade, you have, you know, the bandits who say, it's your money or your life. But then you have the sea raiders who say, I will drink from your skull. And the point is that the bandits just want some cash. The sea raiders want to fight. So it's a difference there, right? And goblins should just want some gold. So yeah, I really like the idea of like goblins, you know, attack the party, but they focus on not like trying to kill everybody, but just on like capturing the character with the least HP so that the other characters will give up, right? That seems like kind of a clever concept. And it also emphasizes the idea of a little bit more like, I hesitate to say realistic, but it's a sort of element of verisimilitude that I think is interesting, the way that like goblins don't want to die in combat. So they just want to, you know, get an easy win and then get out. And anyway, that's the point. But the sort of bigger thing that I wanted to talk about had to do with bringing characters back who otherwise died, essentially. And I'm going to apologize at the beginning because I can't remember the name of the author or the name of the essay that I'm going to reference. But essentially it was an essay that was about in kind of two halves. The first half was about these kind of different sort of theories of storytelling and the nature of storytelling, both kind of the what and the why. And then the second half of the essay was about one of these particular theories, which was the idea of storytelling as a vehicle for miracles. And their point, the sort of central point of this second half of the essay, was that an exception to the established order that happens once is a miracle. An exception that happens twice is cheating. And basically their point was essentially that if you are, they're talking about like, you know, writing, you know, short stories or novels or things like that. But I think the point actually stands pretty well, that, you know, there's a lot of things that you can maybe make an exception with once in a campaign, but if you do it more than once, it's gonna be ruined, right? So like you have Gandalf die and then come back, but he's the only character that can do that in like the whole of Tolkien's Legendarium, right? It happens once because it's a miracle, but if it happened multiple times, it would be a sort of a cheat or a different set of rules, essentially, right? The idea being that if it starts to happen multiple times, it's not an exception. It becomes a kind of different set of rules that the author or the game master, whoever's playing with. I think that's a good way to think about it, that like you can, you know, bring a character who otherwise died back once, in the same way that I think you can, you know, in a given campaign, you can like save the character's bacon with some, you know, like artificial, you know, oh, it turns out that your buddies were around the corner type thing, maybe once, but any more than that, and even once is kind of iffy, but any more than that is going to start to feel not very good. And I think part of that, anyway, I think a big part of that has to do with kind of maintaining expectations, which is say it's a little bit like the idea that like if you're in a negotiation and you give an ultimatum, you have to be prepared to follow through, right? Like if you say, I need a raise or I'm going to quit this job, right? If you don't get the raise, you have to be prepared to quit the job. Otherwise, you won't have any bargaining power the next time you're in a negotiation, right? Because they know that you're going to say ridiculous things that you have no intention of following through with. In the same way, I think, you know, if the GM establishes a situation where like there's serious threats of danger to the characters and then, you know, doesn't follow through with, well, the characters decided to engage in a dangerous way and died, then you end up with, you know, basically what I'm saying is I think you could do it like once at like the end of a campaign or at like a climactic moment, but I wouldn't do it more than that. So I don't know. I guess I don't necessarily think it's impossible to do something like that. And I think there's some interesting stuff you could do with a game where like characters not dying as a consequence was like part of the expectation. So like I think 7C second edition does this, where when a player character basically runs out of the equivalent of running out of hit points, the player gets to decide if that character died or if they just, you know, had a nobody could survive that fall moment. And then they come back later changed somehow in that sort of pulpy way of like, well, they didn't, you know, we didn't find the body, so I guess they didn't die type thing, which is that I think you can do that just fine. I think it's more about kind of having clear expectations that the players and the game master are both buying into, as opposed to when, for instance, something that the players totally did not expect happens, but that interacts with those consequences in a meaningful way. Which is to say that, I don't think you can't do that. And not playing in the game that you're talking about, I don't necessarily know the particular kind of all of the other details that are relevant to that game. So I don't necessarily think, I guess what I'm getting at is I'm not trying to like obliquely criticize the way that Zach is running the game just because I don't know. I just think that there is an element of like sort of cards on the table. How does this actually work? If that makes sense, that is, I think, an important point, at least for me in playing in games, of kind of establishing the kind of agreed upon expectations and then working within those agreed upon expectations, right? If that makes sense. So anyway, that's just some thoughts on bringing characters back.
All right, everybody. I have no idea what happened. I had its little segment here after Arlen's call-in that detailed my thoughts on what he had to say. I had done that on April 15th. Today is now April 27th, I believe. No, April 26th, Tuesday, 2022. It was so bad listening back, trying to figure out what I was doing. I deleted it. But I will say that Arlen had a pretty detailed idea and discussion there about his thoughts on fatality and the idea of bringing people back. I also think that concept of the article certainly is useful in many, many, many different ways, not just character mortality and whether you should bring them back or not, but in any kind of writing, right? And it doesn't have to be miracles, so to speak. It could just be whatever. you know, Deus Ex Machina, Dumasian sorts of plot answers or solutions. They become the norm, then they're bad. I mean, if everything weird is weird, then nothing is weird. That's why you have to keep it limited in your art. But I have to admit, I have been struggling for the past few weeks. I don't know why. Something to do with the weather, maybe. It certainly has a factor. I know there's a lot of stress in the household. Heidi isn't really happy with how her job, and Haley's going to be moving back to our house for a few months, and I know all those things are creating extraneous pressure. But we've got some more call-ins. I'd like to get them going. It has only been a month since they came in, probably. So without further ado, let us thank Arlen for his exquisite call-in and move on to the next ones.
All right, Jace, long time no calling, and I had this whole kind of idea planned, querying this retcon. Retconning, it's something I never quite understood in terms of a word. I mean, I know what it means, but where does it come from? What does it mean? What does it mean? What is retcon? It's like, is it? I know it's just a do-over. It's a, you know, rewind, turn back the clock, all of that stuff. But where does retcon even come from? And who actually cares? Who actually cares? Long time, no chat. Good to hear you. And dang, it's the Easter holidays. I've got a bit of time off work and I thought I'd catch up with a few call-ins. Take care, mate. I'll catch you later.
Hey, Jason, it's Rich. So, retcon, it means retroactive continuity. And it's usually used in, like, I think comic books or TV series has made it more popular. It's when you take something that was established in an original comic or previous comic or series, and then you change it in the future to mean something different. I think retconning is not necessarily a bad thing. I've used retconning before, especially secret retconning. You know, I do that a lot. That's kind of a key to GMing, right? You change things and make connections. I've also retconned it when players have suggested it. They've said, oh, you know, is it because of this? I said, no, it's not, but that's a really good idea. I think it is now. Anyway, retconning, it's okay. Is it too late to change my mind?
Just like sourcing the table, sourcing the screeters is a wonderful and enjoyable experience. So first up, we had Colin from Spike Pit Podcast and Media Empire. Thanks so much for calling in. As you mentioned, long time no chat, my brother. It is great to hear your voice. And it's times when I get like a bunch of call-ins that I really kind of feel like it all matters somehow. Or sometimes I actually feel like I am part of a community, which is wonderful. As I've mentioned previously on here, I think either my bipolarness or my borderline personality disorder stops me from that for whatever reason. But regardless, I wanted to say thank you to Colin. And then to Rich for answering Colin so easily without even knowing Colin had that question. Although I do believe Arlen had already said something similar previously. Though, Rich, I do have a query for you. Is it really retconning if it's secret or if the players don't know about it? Because it hasn't really happened if it hasn't happened at the table, in my opinion. So I don't really think that's retconning if the GM... It's not really written in stone until it happens at the table. So you have the ability to change it. I wouldn't go into Quantum Ogre area and change things willy-nilly. That's an interesting line of distinction. If it is already established and you wrote that's what's going on, but then change it later because you've thought of something cooler. Is it retconning? Does it only happen at the table, or does it happen in the design phase, and if you change it later, it's retconning? I don't know. Inquiring minds want to know. Weigh in, screeters.
Hey, Jason, Carl calling back to respond to your response to retcon, specifically the Dark Heresy game, and because I think you actually had another comment on your in your Discord, so which is kind of cool, I think. Yeah, I think in hindsight, I would have played that off better. Previously in the campaign, the players had woken up, like, you know, and had a hazy memory. And I could have done the same thing had I thought about it a little more and say, and then not just say, okay, well, it didn't really happen, but more like, all right, you guys wake up, you know, tell the psych, oh, your neck is really, you wake up from, seems like a dream and you don't know, you're a little hazy, your memory's a little hazy, you don't know what's going on, psycher, you feel like you're, really your neck is extremely sore. Yeah, but maybe I wasn't as creative back then as I could be now, but that's a great comment and thanks. And I guess the cool thing would have been that the campaign would have continued, because it really, then it wouldn't have been that the player characters had adversarial relations toward each other, but it was that freaking demon that got them. And they probably would have gone to try to hunt down that demon or see where the hell was happening. So that's pretty cool. All right, next time I run a big Dark Heresy campaign, which is a fantastic game, by the way. I like the 40K verse and all that, but maybe that'll be another podcast, another channel, and another time. All right, thanks, Jason.
I think there is often opportunity in the cracks, or the niches, or the dark spaces, the uninformed locations of our mind, or the stories that have already been written, or the campaign settings that we have worked on. That's always been a habit of mine. For a while there, after I finished playing Dungeons and Dragons 2nd edition, during the 3rd edition and 4th edition, before 5th edition started, I played a lot of Hero System and Champions. And the champion setting that I was involved with was called the RCU, which I've talked about before, but hell, I don't know. We're so far in now. I mean, who actually starts at the beginning or remembers what happened previously? I'm not sure I do, which is why I think it's okay to talk about stuff I've already talked about, especially if it's a different solution. The query comes, and when I tread the path, do I end up in the same place or a different place? That's a fascinating aspect of humanity, memory, and time, in my opinion. Yeah, I don't know what I was talking about. I don't know if you're more creative or less creative, or if it would have been okay for them to wake up again since you'd already done it once, a la back to Arlen's miracles from this episode, but I do like the idea of finding these little pieces of it, things that are just like one-sentence anecdotes, like the setting RCU, the RC universe. I think it's Rockford College universe is what it started from, but I wanted to GM things that the other GMs didn't necessarily want to GM within that setting, because I love that exploration of these little things about what if we looked at this. That's why I like some of the really, they're not obscure anymore, but when they first came out, I really enjoyed certain comics like Astro City or the Gotham City police force that was called in after collateral damage occurred from superhero combats. It's just weird that it was in Gotham City. I think that comic would have been way better in Marvel's New York, where you already have the Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Daredevil, all these different heroes and villains living in that relatively small area, and how much damage has to happen. The Avengers, right, are there as well. What's that like? What's that like living there? Which is what Astro City kind of asked those questions. So anyway, that's something I'm super interested in. And it's always good to remember games that happened and ponder them, as long as you don't beat yourself up about it and you actually consider learning and what maybe if something similar happened in the future, what you might be able to do. Which, one of my favorite things, is applying knowledge from gaming into the real world and life. Thanks for calling in, Carl. Much appreciated. If you want to hear more of Carl's self-remembrances or monologues or what have you, check him out on GMologist Presents.
Hey, Jason. This is Taylor of Cleric Swear Ringmail, calling in thinking about rulings, rules, and where Harlan might have been coming from. I think there's a sliding scale as to how heavy or how light a game can be. The rules themselves are a contract. If I'm coming in to play Monopoly, I know that I'm going to move my token around a board, I know I'm going to buy up properties, and I know I'm going to try to drive my buddies out of business. And like Monopoly, a D&D type game is going to have those rules, have those expectations that are built into it. How closely the group adheres to those rules and those expectations represents their placement on the sliding scale. And that scale has to be tailored to the table involved. Playing BX, or Old School Essentials, for example, I make the assumption I'm going to be delving dungeons, fighting, or talking to monsters, and trekking across the wilderness. Reading the book, that's what the game seems to be about. You can have a sliding scale on theme, on the tone, so I may have an all diplomacy, a world tour campaign, a city crawl, or maybe some extra heavy roleplay, but from where Arlen was coming from, I think he was talking more mechanics. So, mechanically, we can slide the scale slightly to one side by allowing sundered shields. Sundered shields I would consider a minor change. It gives characters with shields more survivability, but it doesn't come up very often, because a lot of the time it's used to save the character's life, and it also contributes to an element of resource management and balancing risk. Can I carry another shield? How will I handle future combats if I don't have a shield? Which is one of the core things that happens in BX play. Sliding the scale more, I would say, is introducing usage dice. Usage dice introduce dramatic tension and fundamentally change the way resource management operates. An element of uncertainty can undermine, with a couple consecutive bad rolls, planning on the part of the players that would otherwise have been exhaustive and well-received without usage dice. In that sense, usage dice represent a different perspective, a different style of play than the implications of the rules as written. In so doing, that might drive a player away who isn't into that style of play. Or cantrips. Giving magic users cantrips, in the unlimited sense of the word, it may seem more magical, more tonal to the wizard archetype, but it can interfere with other elements of the game, making the magic user shine more, but also allowing him to step on the toes of other character classes. That could be game-breaking, and insidiously so, as it's not immediately obvious. So, which end of the scale do you prefer? That's a good question, and a personal one. You have the LBBs on one side, where the game expects you to complete it based off of a framework they provide, and then, say, AD&D on the other, where there's a rule for everything if you look hard enough. I would say it's an old versus new thing, but really it's not. While some newer games or newer editions do try to have a rule for everything, other new games, look at itch.io, these indie games that keep coming out, there's a wealth of rules light to the point of being incomplete, even more so than original D&D. These games cater to people who prefer the more freeform style. Personally, for me, I'm happy either way, so long as there's consistency. For me, if we have a ruling, but we're consistent with that ruling, it allows me to plan for situations where it comes up. And that is what makes the game work in my little Taylor brain. Food for thought.
This Taylor of Cleric's Wear Ringmail famous blog and podcast is one of my fears. Coming up with a ruling that I'm happy with at the time, but then later learning that it is not consistent with a previous one. I'm terrible at this personally, in gaming and in life in many ways. Why do we have to try and reinvent the wheel when things happen? Why am I not better at remembering what worked and just using that in the future? It just seems like just a wonderful method for being successful in life. I got to get better at it. I also think that you're totally correct in the aspect of Arlen's messages, his interest in mechanics really informing styles of play and giving players interesting choices, specifically tactically in combat. But not only, because I also know that he was a fan of the One Ring and probably Burning Wheel and some other games that actually deal with not just combat but other aspects of a game's mechanisms or systems. So very insightful and thought-provoking, and like I say, I appreciate you. I feel a little disappointed, and it makes me saddened to think of all the times that I have failed being consistent, especially with rulings. But I mean, I try to write them down when I can, but I don't do a great job of it, especially these days where I feel distracted against creativity, which really kind of hurts my heart. Let's get into that.
If he is up or down, his podcast still comes round. Hobbs is in his van, don't turn off that sat nav, man. Random screed, don't know what you get, but it's what you need.
Status report. I haven't played or ran a lot. I don't know if I've ran at all, honestly. Tried to. Work's gotten in the way. I have been able to play once in a while the Tuesday night game, Zach's game, that I've been commenting on over the last few episodes of Random Screed continues. In fact, we recently were attempting to solve a mystery about a dragon in the area, and in fact found the dragon and slew it. My character was still first level until after that fight. I now have a second level elf in OSE. How are we able to slay a dragon with mostly first and second level characters? Well, I think a lot of that comes down to the plan that we had and the execution of the plan and the success of that execution. But also is the way dragons are written in BX or OSE. They don't fly. They only occasionally use their breath weapon. But more appropriately explained is the power of the spell light. I have learned of this through my own running of BX over the years, specifically Kalmata probably, and in Basic in 1981, the spell light cast on an opponent's eyes prohibited them from attacking in combat. They can't even attack. That's pretty powerful. Let's talk about an encounter stopper. So I memorized light for my elf, and I had the NPC first level spellcaster Menlos also memorize light, just in case he made it saving. The creature made it saving throw. If it didn't, what's it hurt? I mean, we already blinded it. And I don't use that ruling. I allow things to attack still, just because I think it being blind doesn't stop you from being able to attack. It stops you from being able to attack nearly as successfully. I give a -4 to any attacks. Maybe it should be higher. I don't know. What do you guys think? The light spell. How powerful is it? How debilitating should it be for a creature affected by it? There's a lot of the spells in BX that are really kind of... I mean, they're encounter stoppers, like sleep, light, web. They're just kind of interesting. I wish that I had created more spells. Like, I've added Burning Hands, Shocking Grasp, through the way that I bring new spells in, usually through NPCs or spell books. But I guess really what I wanted to talk about is killing that dragon in that game. Light spell and some good attack rolls. And the creature did fight back. He did liquefy one of our NPCs, Dirk the Daring. And he clawed somebody else. I don't know how powerful the dragon was. I've never even looked up dragon in BX. A lot of times I'm reskinning my own creatures anyway. I don't know. What do you guys think? That was the question about light spell. It was all wrapped up into status report, which I am really discombobulated. We had tons and tons of call-ins and responses, but another nuanced bit of information is the fact that Gaming and BS is pulling the plug. They got one more month of episodes, four more episodes, and they're done. I admire them for what they've accomplished and for the way they are finishing what they've accomplished. As you can see, my ability to podcast has greatly diminished. I've also mentioned to Sean many times that I would do a show with him if he wanted to. Also, Julian and I have discussed doing a show. I don't know. I don't know if the world is ready. I don't know if I'm ready, if I have the bandwidth emotionally, mentally, or time-wise. Would that be time-wise or chronologically? I don't know. But I can't really tell you a good reason that I haven't been screeding more often. I'm in my car all the time, but I'm usually listening to music. I'm not even listening to other podcasts unless it's like a sales podcast or something. But I haven't really had the time to game that much either. I'd like to change that. I know I have NTRPG coming up. I have the Great Bird Migration that I need to run some stuff for. I've really been wanting to write. I haven't even been doing that. Is it resistance? Is it extraneous pressure? Is it I'm just not that creative anymore? I don't know. What I do know is I've appreciated all the call-ins, and I've appreciated all the listens. Give me a shout-out, y'all. Talk to you soon. Better to burn out than to fade away. What am I doing? Fading away. Not burning out. Gaming and BS is burning out. They did it. Kudos to you, my brothers. Brett and Sean, cheers.